On that note, we'll begin. I want to welcome everybody. I just thought, I was thinking, you know, this week's, you know, Parsha, I don't know if you're going to talk about it, but the whole sugya of women and learning Torah is a result of this week's Parsha on the Sota. That's the beginning of the entire Talmudic discussion, should a woman study the oral Torah? But we have Dina Berkowitz, Rabbanita Dina Berkowitz, is really one of the leaders and the pioneers of women learning, and it's a pleasure to welcome her. She's the scholar in residence at Kol HaNeshama in New York City, the senior educator, Manhattan Jewish Experience. She works as a therapist on top of that, and she teaches Torah in many circles, and she wrote the first Siddur authored by women, Orthodox Siddur by women. So it's a pleasure to welcome her on a pretty short notice to give the Parsha share, and thank you very much.
Rabbi Kelman, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with everyone this evening. And I just want to dedicate this year to Refuah Shlema for all those who are ill and for the healing of racial harmony, in particular in the United States, because we've just been racked for over a week now and no one knows where the tikkun is going to happen. So hopefully our learning will open up the gates of mercy and people will have a refuah, both on the physical level and on the spiritual and the, I would say, justice level as well. So this week's Parsha Naso is the longest Parsha in the Torah. It's always read after Shavuot, Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora. And it's interesting because there's, as Rabbi Kelman said, and I have to say your Torah emotion activities are absolutely amazing. The length and breadth of what you do and present is terrific. And I'm very honored to be a part of it this evening. But this is a Parsha where we could talk about so many things. As Rabbi Kelman mentioned, we could just focus on the whole issue of the wayward wife of the Sota. And it's something that's a subject, especially in modern times, of what does this ordeal mean vis-a-vis putting a woman accused of adultery through this? Did it ever really happen, etc.? We could talk about that. We could talk about the Nazir. My connection with the Nazir was that a friend of our family was Rabbi Sharya Shuv Cohen, a blessed memory, who was the chief rabbi of Haifa for many years. And his father, the late Rabbi David Cohen, was the Nazir of Jerusalem. And it was interesting because Rabbi Cohen, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, that Sharya Shuv, would come from time to time when he was in New York, and he would come to our house. He was a vegetarian. He followed through on a number of things from his father that he didn't eat meat. He did cut his hair, but he did not drink wine. And that's what I remember about our dinners when he came. And he explained to us, it was quite interesting that when he was younger, it was almost like he was being groomed by his father for the role of Mashiach. I kid you not. He told us that. And he ended up on a slightly different path, but one that he was an incredible beacon of light, not only within the Jewish world and in Israel, but for people who were also not observant within Israel and also in interfaith dialogue. So that's always, when I think of a Nazir, I think of his father. So there's a lot to talk about that. But what I decided to do was to focus on the part of the Parsha that contains the priestly blessings, the blessings that in Israel, it's done every day. In the diaspora, it's only done on the Yom Tovim, where the Kohanim go up. This is like the last, like the only sort of remnant we have of certain, you know, I would say high drama of something that began in the Mishkan in the desert. It was later incorporated in the Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem. And as we know, after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the Chachamim, our sages incorporated this priestly blessing that is in Parshat Naso into the synagogue prayer service. It's something that we say all the way at the end of davening as part of the repetition of the service. But on the high holidays, on the Shalosh Regalim, the Kohanim will go up and actually lift their hands and bless everybody. And of course, if I were to ask when else do the both the Kohanim and the non-Kohanim have access to uttering the prayer of the priestly blessing. In particular, it's used by parents, it's said by parents on Shabbat in blessing their children. So the question that I thought I would look at and share with you tonight is really trying to understand, first of all, who can actually say those words, who can actually say the blessing. Number two, to look at what does each of the three blessings actually rather mean, and also what is the meaning, I'll kind of save that for last, of the bracha that the Kohanim say before they bestow the blessing on as part of a congregation. What is the understanding of it? So, you know, when I think of the of this blessing and the Kohanim, there's, you know, probably, I'm sure Rabbi Kelman is familiar with it. I'm sure most of us are familiar. If I were to say what is like one of the oldest Jewish jokes out there, this is one of them, of the story of the man who comes to his rabbi and he says, "Rabbi, I want to become a Kohen." So the rabbi says, I can't make you a Kohen. So the man says, "I'll give you $25,000 for you to make me a Kohen." So he said, I can't, it's just not for sale. So the man said, "I'm going to up it to 50,000. And he keeps upping it. And the rabbi keeps saying no. Finally, he offers the rabbi $250,000, $250,000, to become a Kohen. The rabbi, you know, realizes, my gosh, we need a new roof. The electrical system is failing. All right, who's going to really know? It's so important to him. Fine. So the rabbi says, okay, a deal. I'll make you a Kohen. So and the rabbi says, but I'm curious. Why is it so important for you to be a Kohen? To which the man answers, because my father was a Kohen. My grandfather was a Kohen, right? So it's probably one of those jokes that's best told in Yiddish because it seems so obvious. But in essence, I think it also relates this idea of something that is passed down where essentially people do not have to earn it. There was an old commercial, I think, for E.F. Hutton or one of the brokerage firms, something like, you know, because like, you know, because they we earn it. Like most, many things, for example, the Torah's discussion of the Nazir, that's something that someone takes upon themselves. It's like they're an uber Kohen. They're so holy that they don't want to do certain things. But a Kohen, whether you want it or not, you're a Kohen, you know, because your father is a Kohen, your grandfather is a Kohen. But the question is, why are the Kohanim given this right to bless? In other words, we get blessings from God, but why do we need human beings to bless people at all? It's God that we know that blesses humanity. And why does he need any kind? Why does God need a human intermediary? So we'll come to that as well. So what we see in Sefer HaChinuch is that it simply says that priests were the sacred group within the people. They were the ones that had been picked from Aharon, from Aaron, to minister, to be the functionaries in Beit Hashem. They spent their lives in divine service. Their lives were sacred. And that, as Rabbi Sacks explains, they were the guardians of holiness. And therefore, it would make sense for the obvious choice for the sacred rite of bringing down God's blessing upon the people would be through them. In one commentary I read, it was so interesting, is that it said that Rabbi Aharon Walkin, Rabbi Sacks references him, says that there's maybe a more understandable reason why the Kohanim were given this, because what do we know that differentiated the Kohanim from the other tribes that we find? And that is that they didn't have a share in the land. They were not in any way landowners. And where did their sole income come from? From the gifts that were given to them. So Rabbi Walkin says that they then had an interest in the people prospering, because then they too would prosper. And then they would then be the ones to bless people, because at the end of the day, sort of, they had perhaps somewhat of a, I don't want to call it a selfish reason, but they had a vested interest that people should prosper and do well, because it would come to them. And that, I think, touches on the nature of the bracha that they will make. So we'll come back to that at the end. After we've looked at the different brachot, we'll take a look at why they make a specific bracha before Kohanim Duchen that we can't find anywhere else, because it invokes the idea of love. All right. So the first thing is that what do we see in the Torah? So we see in the Torah that it says God speaks to Moshe and says, "Daber el Aharon ve'el banav lemor, ko tivarchu et bnei Yisrael amor lahem." So speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, "So shall you bless the children of Israel," saying to them. So that is in the plural, and then we read the blessing. So one question that has come up was, can someone who is not a Kohen recite Birkat Kohanim? What we find is Rabbi Moshe Isserles, who lived in the 16th century, the Ramah, writes that a non-Kohen who recites Birkat Kohanim transgresses the mitzvah of this verse, which implies that Kohanim should recite the blessing, but no others. Now, what we do know is that as part of Birchat HaTorah that we say in the morning, what is one of the brachot that we make, right? We say, Yivarechacha Hashem v'yishmerecha. So people who are non-Kohanim, including women, recite the verses of Birkat Kohanim after Birkat HaTorah. So some explain that and say that the difference is that there we're reading the verses as a form of Torah study and not as blessings. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen, who lived in the 19th century into the 1930s and the 20th century, commented on the statement of the Ramah. He said, "In this light, we have to wonder then at the widespread practice that people, whether they are Kohanim or not, bless each other by reciting the words of Birkat Kohanim when they take leave from travelers. How is this permitted?" So the Chafetz Chaim explained. At first glance, he said, one might argue that since the blessings are recited outside the context of the prayers, in other words, they're not recited the way a Kohen would recite them, there is no prohibition. However, this cannot be correct, since it's only a rabbinic ordinance to recite Birkat Kohanim during prayer. The Torah had no such thing in mind. Thus, when the Torah implicitly prohibited a non-Kohen from blessing others using this formula, it must have meant that the prohibition should apply all of the time. But the Chafetz Chaim said that here is a way that this widespread practice could be justified. And he goes on to explain that there's a dispute at the beginning in the Talmud, and it continued with later authorities, about whether one fulfills a mitzvah if the person does the act of the mitzvah but has no thought of performing the mitzvah. So, for example, one of the examples he gives is, suppose the question is, do you fulfill a mitzvah if you play music on a shofar on Rosh Hashanah and you just happen to emit Tekiya Shavarim Teruah Tekiya, even though you didn't have the Havamina, you didn't have the intent of doing a mitzvah? So the Chafetz Chaim says the existence of the widespread practice mentioned above is proof that we hold that fulfillment of a mitzvah does require proper intentions, right? That it needs the proper kavana, because that is what we hold, a non-Kohen would transgress the prohibition on blessing others with the Birkat Kohanim only if he had in mind to fulfill the mitzvah of Birkat Kohanim thereby. Without such an intention, he's not attempting to usurp the mitzvah of the Kohanim and commits no transgression. So again, when I read this, it made me think about all of the bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs I've been to, where often at the conclusion of the rabbi's speech, inspirational speech to the bar bat mitzvah and to the family, they, how do they conclude? And now we're, I want to bless you with the ancient blessing, Yivarechacha. The rabbi is not a Kohen necessarily. And again, but they're not acting as a Kohen would. Okay. So the Chafetz Chaim also writes, alternatively, that perhaps the general populace accepts the opinion of the Bach, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, who lived in the 16th century into the 17th century, that non-Kohanim are prohibited from using the Birkat Kohanim only if they recite the blessings with their two hands outstretched like the Kohanim do. Thus, when friends part along the road, they may bless each other with the Birkat Kohanim. So that raises an interesting question also, because when parents then are blessing their children Friday night with Birkat Kohanim, so the first thing is they're not thinking they're like the Kohanim duchening in front. So therefore they're not, you know, going over, you know, they're not transgressing that. But what do many parents do? They take both their hands and they'll put it on their children's head. Now, I have to digress for a moment and say that probably one of like the greatest, I would say, examples of how something from our tradition ended up as part of popular culture and its impact in the following story, which some of you might know. So the late Leonard Nimoy was an actor. Exactly, Mr. Langer, and as he demonstrated, and he was from Boston, and his grandfather, who was Orthodox, took him to a shul, Orthodox shul. So Leonard Nimoy told the story that when he was a little boy, went with his grandfather to shul on Yontif. His grandfather, right when they were about to have Birkat Kohanim, the duchening. Duchening is Yiddish. It means, because it's the platform, because the Kohanim like essentially go up on the bima to be higher. It's not something they do from within their seat. And the grandfather turned to Leonard and said, okay, whatever you do, don't look. Now, first rule of parenting is that if you tell a child not to do something, what are they going to do? They're going to do it, right? Most often they'll do it at least once. So he didn't listen to his grandfather and he peeked. And what did he see? He saw the Kohanim raise their hands and make sort of like, you know, the two V symbol, you know, the symbols of the Kohanim. And it sort of filed back in his, you know, his brain, and that, you know, and there, and then he went on and ended up in Hollywood and ends up, being cast in Star Trek, which had a big success, but it was canceled. Then they brought it back. And even to this day, he is Oliver Sholem now. You know, you have Trekkie conventions. It's very, very popular. They redid it. And Leonard Nimoy told the story that when Gene Roddenberry, who was, I think, the producer and sort of one of the writers of the show, came together, and he said, you know, you, Leonard Nimoy, you're going to play this role, Mr. Spock, but you need some kind of hand gesture, you know, is like a symbol. And what, you know, we need to come up with something. And bingo, the pintalayid in Leonard Nimoy's brain, ding, ding, ding. He goes, I have it. So Gene Roddenberry says, what is it? He says, it's the symbol of the priests, right? The Klingons, I think, if I'm up on my Star Trek trivia, no, what is it? Mr. Langer knows if he unmutes. I don't remember. I was not a Star Trek fan. I like Leonard Nimoy, but I was not a Trekkie. I still am not a Trekkie. In any event, that's how the symbol of the Kohanim ended up as Vulcans. That's it. Thank you. It ended up as the symbol on Star Trek. It was amazing. Now, it then took on a life of its own afterwards. I read this story in the New Yorker a number of years ago, where a man who I believe was a Holocaust survivor decided to go back to Eastern Europe, to Poland, and he took his grandson on a pre-bar mitzvah tour. He wanted to take him not just to see the death camps, but he wanted to take him to see his hometown as best as he could, and he was able to take him to the cemetery where his family was buried, because for some reason That cemetery was not destroyed, luckily, during the Holocaust. So he takes his pre-bar mitzvah grandson with him. They end up in the cemetery, and the grandson is looking at all the different matzevas. He's looking at all the different tombstones, and thereupon he sees a tombstone that was obviously the burial of someone who was a Kohen. And what did they put at the top of that tombstone? They put the sign of the kahuna, the fingers of the blessing. The little boy who was, watched a lot of television, turned to his grandfather and said, "Zadie," he said, "I had no idea." He said, "Back when you were little, people were Star Trek fans." The grandfather didn't know what he was talking about. He said, "What are you talking about?" And then he said, "No, look, look, the sign of the Vulcans is on this tombstone." So as you can see, the concept of what the Kohanim do has entered popular culture and has come back again, that some people don't even know its origins, but we do. So to come back to this question, when parents bless their children on Shabbat, is it a problem with them using two hands? Because is that then mimicking the Kohanim, that no one is going to think they're Mr. Spock with his Vulcan symbol, but are they going to think that they're Kohanim? So we find one opinion that says, no, parents should not use two hands. And in fact, this Rabbi Grunwald says that the custom of the Ari Zatzal was only to use one hand. So except we find, interestingly, that Rabbi Yaakov Emden lived in the 18th century, died around, I think, 1776. He strongly defended the custom of using two hands to bless one's children. And he writes that this is how one blesses another generously. And the fact that this is what the Kohanim do is proof that this is the right way to bless another. He mentions that Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to bless Joshua Yehoshua generously. So what did he do? He used two hands. And when Jacob, our forefather, blessed Yosef's children, what did he do? He also used two hands. Rabbi Emden said, had there been only one grandchild to bless, Yaakov Avinu would have placed both of his hands on that one grandchild. So that's the proof that it seems that it's perfectly fine. And therefore, Rabbi Emden concludes, you should use two hands. It's interesting because, we're talking about potentially a non-Kohen blessing their children. So that, I think, kind of gives us an idea about why the Kohanim and why is it okay for us to sort of in some way mimic the Kohanim. But the next thing then I wanted to look at is what exactly are the blessings? So the first blessing is Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmarecha, right? May Hashem bless you and safeguard you. And what's interesting is what we find that the Netziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who lived in the 19th century, he picks up on something very interesting. And that is the language. That is the grammar. And I always say, I should have paid more attention in sixth grade to grammar in my Hebrew grammar class, because it continually comes up and the grammar is always a very interesting giveaway. Because if we go back to the Pasuk, and we're in Naso, if you want to bring it up on your phone or you have a Chumash handy, it's Perek Vav, it's chapter 6, it's Pasuk Chaf Bet, continuing to Chaf Vav, is that it says, God says to Moshe, right, speak to Aaron, and what does it say? It's saying, Ko Tivrechu et B'nei Yisrael. There we see it in the plural. But when we actually get to the blessing, it's May Hashem bless you and safeguard you. It's Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmarecha. It means that each person is not being blessed in the plural, but implies that the blessing is appropriate to each person, to each individual. It applies to each individual. And therefore, that when you are blessing someone, in essence, what the Nitziv says, you're blessing each person in a manner unique to their needs. So that's the first part, Yirerechecha Hashem. And then what does the second part say? V'yishmerecha. And God will keep you. God will guard you. What's interesting about that is that the Nitziv said that a blessing, he says, requires guardianship. So it should not, God forbid, be turned to a wrong purpose. The Torah scholar requires guardianship to save them from pride and bringing the name of Hashem in disrepute and the like. The business person requires guardianship against their wealth becoming a stumbling block to him, as in the case of Korach, and in a literal sense, against theft and loss. So that what we see, according to the Nitziv, is that while the first half of this line establishes that God's grace will be uniquely reflected in each person, the second half of the verse promises that God will help a person use their best qualities only to increase good in the world and not to allow that those qualities should anyway stain that person's name. So that God doesn't want, for example, someone's learning to become a source of arrogance or their money to become a way of one-upmanship. It has to be used properly. I found a quote from Dr. Chaim Guinot that was directed to teachers, in which he was concerned about how people could use their knowledge for terrible things. He wrote many years ago, he wrote, "I'm a survivor of a concentration camp." He said, "My eyes saw what no man should witness. Gas chambers built by learned engineers, children poisoned by educated physicians, infants killed by trained nurses, women and babies shot and burned by high school and college graduates." He goes on to say, "So I'm suspicious of education. My request is help your students become human. Your efforts must never produce learned monsters, skilled psychopaths, educated Eichmanns. Reading, writing, and arithmetic are important only if they serve to make our children more human." So I'm reminded of something that the late, great Nobel laureate, Holocaust survivor, Elie Wiesel, of blessed memory, once said, where he said, "Our job is not to make the world more Jewish, but to make the world more humane. It's to make it more merciful." And when we see here, when we circle back to this blessing, that's the idea that it's not just that God should bless us, but we also are asking for that guardianship, that it shouldn't in any way be turned to a wrong purpose. I think one of the most often questions that I get from so many people who are no longer observant, or people who want to become observant, or people who are observant, but they're just so plagued. How, you know, the classic thing, you know, why do, you know, bad things happen to good people? This is more a question along the lines of how can people who claim to be Orthodox, to be religious, to be observant, nonetheless behave in such a reprehensible manner? So that's, I think, here what we see is that it's really the idea that the blessing is going to be established for each of us, but we are asking that God will help us use our best qualities only to increase good in the world and not to allow those qualities to stain not only that person's name, but as I've seen, we see where, unfortunately, if observant people get caught up in things, it ends up becoming a Chilul Hashem. That in essence, you know, we have to really always live our lives as a Kiddush Hashem. So that, and Hashem doesn't want us, our intelligence and our achievements, to be used in the wrong way. Because as we know, we all, the sages point to the fact that we all, in essence, do need a Yetzirah, because they say without a Yetzirah, we wouldn't build a house, and we wouldn't have a profession, and we wouldn't get married, because those are the things that sort of, you know, that's our drive. Freud described it, you know, as the id, the ego, and the superego. So in our language, we need those things. But the Yetzer Tov is there to moderate and to let the good come out, and it's really the proper use of those inclinations that we have to allow the good to come out. So that's on the first blessing. The second blessing that we come to, that it says Ya'er Hashem Panav Elecha V'chuneka, right? And it says, may Hashem illuminate God's countenance for you and be gracious to you. So what does exactly that mean? What does it mean, may God illuminate God's countenance for you? And what we find is that may God shed light. And what is the one way that God sheds light? It's through Torah. And that, again, Rambam Maimonides, you know, would have, I'm sure, difficulties with this, because these are anthropomorphisms we say about God's face. But as we know, and Rambam explained, and we explained, we need to understand things with these imagery, because it's easier for us to grasp it. So that the one way to understand this is that if we see that God is shedding light, and then v'yichuneka, and then we will find graciousness. We will find God will be gracious to us. And the commentators say, is it that God will be gracious to us, or will our chen? You know, that's a v'yichuneka, right? So the idea of chen, I like it in the Yiddish, like when you say someone has chen, it's like they have something about their personality that shines forth, that it glows. And some say that it's the other people will find the beauty in us, that it's not just that we'll find favor in God's eyes, but we'll find favor in those around us. So that the Sifra says that the commandments is a lamp and the Torah is a light. So we really hope then that Hashem will illuminate, will provide light. We're living now at a time, certainly speaking, living within the United States, living in New York, some of my own friends are on the Zoom tonight. So those are living in the United States. We feel it's very dark, and we need Hashem's light. We need that illumination, and we need people to understand what it means to behave a certain way and to care about others and to have greater insight. So that I think is one way of understanding the second blessing. When we get to the third blessing, what's I think so fascinating about that is that what does it say there? It says Yisa Hashem Panav Elecha V'yasem Lecha Shalom, and may God lift God's countenance to you and establish peace for you. So that what's interesting here is that we're saying that God should shine God's face upon us and give us shalom. Now, if I were to grab 10 people off the street, even in as Jewish a city as New York, and I say, could you please tell me, what does the word shalom mean? It's probably the one word that most Jews probably would know what it means. And it has really, as we'll see tonight, we know that it means shalom means hello. We know that shalom means peace, and that's how it's translated, right? It says V'yasem lecha shalom, and God will establish peace for us. But shalom also has a different connotation, and that is one of shleimut, one of what we might call wholeness, or one of completeness. And the fact is that here too, each individual is meant to feel that sense of completeness, of shleimut within him or herself, to feel secure and unafraid. And that the idea of the blessing is to understand that the value of our lives is dependent on what we do, and not necessarily even the opinions of others. And when God shines God's countenance upon us as an individual, we then begin to understand that our life is ultimately defined by the relationship of ourselves with God. So that God, again, this idea of God's light emanating the shadows and the doubts, here what we have is that idea of shleimut, of that idea of wholeness. And when you have that sense of wholeness, what then emerges? You have peace. The concept of peace became for the rabbis so important, is that how do we end, right? How do we end Kaddish? How do we end the Shmona Esrei? What do we say, right? Oseh shalom bimromav, hu yaaseh shalom aleinu v'al kol Yisrael. So that shalom, this idea of peace, it's not just peace, it's not just external peace, it's also internal peace. And that I think that idea is something that very often people can seem outwardly very, very happy, very taken care of, everything is good, but they don't have a completeness. There's something missing. So that, I think, I hope, explains for us a little bit about what these brachot mean. But I then, before we finish up, and if we have some time for questions, one of the interesting things about the Birkat Kohanim is, what is the blessing that the Kohanim make before they bestow the blessing? And the blessing is, Baruch Atah Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Asher Kedishanu B'Kedushato Shel Aharon, V'tzivanu Levarech Et Amo Yisrael Ba'ahava. So blessed are you, Hashem, our God, sovereign of the universe, who has sanctified us with the holiness of Aharon and has commanded us to bless God's people Israel with love. Now, I have a question to ask you. Can you think of any other bracha? Is there any other bracha that requires us to bless or to do something with love? Right? I think when we think about this, very often people would, you know, the canard, the libel against Judaism that was said by early proponents of Christianity, of course, was that Judaism was not a religion. It was a religion of stern justice of God, but it's not a religion of love. And I always point to this and I say, this is proof. Look at this. Here we are, that for the Kohanim to bless us, okay, it has to be with love. And that, I think, that answers one of the other interesting things that I've also heard people say who don't like Birkat Kohanim. And why don't they like Birkat Kohanim? Well, they say, who gives the right? The guy that is getting called up to bless us, that guy, that particular Kohen, he's a miserable human being. They can go through, he's terrible as a landlord, he's evil as a, all types of things. What do you mean he's making that bracha? He doesn't deserve to be up there. It's a shanda, it's a harpa, shouldn't be there. So the way I always answer that is, I answer it by something that we find in the Zohar, and that is that the Zohar says, a priest, a Kohen who does not love the people, or a Kohen who is not loved by the people, may not bless. We can only bless what we love, according to the Zohar, and we can only, in essence, that who is not loved may not bless. Now, what does that mean? That basically means that whoever gets up there who doesn't really have the best interests of Jewish people at heart, or others like feel that, you know, that he really, you know, doesn't belong up there, I always say it just doesn't count. I mean, hopefully he's not the single Kohen that's getting up. That might be a little bit of a problem. But I think it's a mystical idea here, that the idea is that it has to be with love. All our other mitzvot, what do we strive for? We strive for intention. We strive for kavana, right? But with the Kohanim, what we find is that they have to have this love. They have to have, it's not just the kavana. It's not just what we spoke about in the first part, that when the kohanim get up there, they have the intention of blessing the people. So therefore, if we don't see ourselves of kohanim, it isn't a problem with us making that blessing. But the example is, and Rabbi Sacks explains this so beautifully, is that he points out the difference that when they're coming up to also give the bracha, it is not they, the Kohanim, that are giving this bracha to us. Rather, the Kohanim are really vessels. They're really representatives of God, in which he says that God is the doer, but the Kohanim are the enablers. They are the ones that are just, that they're the conduits through which this bracha comes. And it's a reminder then that there's a constant partnership between God my laptop is about to die, so let me just plug this in. But it's a constant reminder that there is a partnership between Hashem. And when we think about the lines that we're a mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, it's not just the kohanim are kohanim, but in essence, we all have, I would say, a holiness, and we all have a special task to really increase that love for everyone. And if the kohanim are seeking what we might say is to the good of everyone, then in essence, then they're the right kohanim. So they are really just the vessels through which God expresses our love for us. And the kohanim are really meant to model for us the ideal behavior and to always express our love. And I think that's true for us, that we have to express our love for our fellow Jews, both not only through our words, but our deeds, because in that way we become, when we say mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh, that's what it means to have a kingdom of a priest and a holy nation, that we have to all set the example, not just the kohanim, of exalted living and behavior to the whole world. I thought about that because of something that I learned from the Ketav Sofer that says that in the last bracha where we ask that God bestow God's favor us and grant us peace, Ketav Sofer teaches us that there are three levels of peace. He says there's peace within our homes and families, within our community and country, and throughout the world. And he says that in order for true peace to exist is when we have harmony between all three. So I thought about that because of what's just happening in our country, that it's not just about that we have satisfaction at home, but we have to really create an atmosphere of harmony and feeling that everybody is part of the human humanity, and that whether they're Jews, Gentiles, whites, African Americans, Latinos, anybody of any ethnic background, we have to try to work on having that true peace. Again, not just peace, but as I said earlier, shleimut, because when you have peace, you have harmony. I'll conclude with the idea that I had mentioned, that we say Oseh Shalom Bimromav, and the custom is when we say that, at the end of the Shmona Esrei, we turn to the left, we turn to the right, and we turn to the middle. I remember once learning from Rabbi Ralph Pelkovitz, who was a rabbi of the White Shul for many years, great Talmud Chacham, a great Darshan, in which he said, why do we turn to the left? Why do we turn to the right? Why do we turn to the middle? He said, because we have to recognize that there are Jews to our left, there are Jews to our right, and there are Jews in the middle, and we have to try to create that shleimut. And I think that that is the idea behind Birkat Kohanim, and I think that that is the idea between them bestowing really as the conduit to blessing, especially because they're raising their hands. It's the idea of their hands going up. It's what even the word naso means, which is, it's understood to mean to lift, to carry, and sometimes even to forgive. That's what we see here. So in this parsha, so that we have to kind of get on their coattails, or I guess on their talesim, and hopefully we'll have more shleimut and more shalom within not only our Jewish community and our Jewish world, but the world as a whole. If anyone has any comments or anyone has questions, please either put it on the chat or unmute yourself and participate.
Thank you. While people are thinking, I'll just make an interesting comment that I really thought of. My father, Alav Shalom, actually did not bless us with Yivarechech Hashem Yishmerech. He just started the Yisim Kalohim, my older sister, Kasar Rivka Recha Valeya, yeah, and that's what I do, of course, to my kids. I'm just sort of wondering if maybe it's related because of the problem. They didn't want to say Berchas Kohanim is non-Kohanim. But, you know, anyways, just...
It's also, you know, that's something also that I once came across a question that someone who was a rabbi in the liberal community asked, should the, since in the non-Orthodox world, everything is egalitarian, they said, should we be changing the tenses of the blessing when you bestow it on a girl? It was interesting. It was, so they said no, because it's a pasuk from the Torah. We're not going to change it. So, it, you know, this is something I think it raises all kinds of questions. But, you know, I think of, when I think of Birkat Kohanim, I not, you know, I think of just that imagery. Again, I was a kid who didn't look. I still don't look. That imagery of them going up, and this is the last, like the last kind of thing that we sort of have, you know, what I consider high drama, aside from maybe the Avoda service on Yom Kippur, of the image of everybody, like kind of, you know, putting their talesim over their head, everyone, you know, the women kind of looking down, like there's this aura. It's such a moment of spirituality. It's really, it's quite interesting.